For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Thank you so much. In 1992, I was about ready to watch the Southeastern Conference Football Championship. Now, I know I'm in different territory, but you can tell by my accent, I ain't from Columbus. And for the first time in history, the Southeastern Conference Football Conference was going to have a championship game, and the two teams that were going to play were the University of Alabama and the University of Florida. No Gators. Don't like Gators. I'm a graduate of the University of Alabama. Some couple came to me 6 months earlier and shared with me that they wanted to get married on that date. I shared with them in Christian love that they were idiots. I told them, I said, don't you know that the Southeastern Conference Football Championship is going to be on that date? We didn't know who the teams were going to be, but everybody would be watching it in that part of the South. The bride looked at the groom, and she said, tell him that doesn't matter. The groom said, it doesn't matter. It did matter. The father of the bride threatened to boycott the wedding. Well, I tried to put on my spiritual hat, if you will. And I said, okay, I'll do the wedding. I began to have deep regrets about that commitment as the day approached. I had suspected that my alma mater would be in the football championship, the inaugural event, and it was true. I did everything I could to try to get out of that wedding. I suggested to them that I might could get Billy Graham to come do their wedding. No. And so the time for the wedding was right after the first half. It was an intense game. The two teams were going back and forth. I was in my office watching the game and doing a little prayer for the wedding as well, but mainly watching the game. And as I was watching the game, it got time where the third quarter had come to an end. And someone knocks on my office door and says, it's time. I felt like someone about to be a dead man walking down death row. I felt like they'd come to get me for my last rites. They said, it's time. I said, can you tell them to wait about 30 more minutes? It was time. I had Plan B in place. Plan B was a small color television set off to my right where those who were attending the wedding could not see it. On mute, no sound, but with a screen where I and anyone else standing near me could have clear visibility. The game was 21-14, Alabama. But Florida was making a fierce comeback, and that's when I walked out to do the wedding. I walk out and the processional takes place. The bride stands before, and the groom is there. And I say a few words. I don't really recall what they were. And then it is time for a solo while the entire wedding party is standing there. I turn my head in this direction. Florida is driving with 21-14, the score. Florida, the quarterback, goes back to throw a pass that looks like it is going to be a certain touchdown that will tie the football game. Instead, his arm slips. It's an errant throw. Antonio Langham, the linebacker for Alabama, intercepts the pass, and he starts running and running, and all of a sudden I yell out, run, fool, run! I lost my focus. Every December, I get a card from the bride who says, I still hate you. I lost my focus. Zenith has been one of those churches that my team and I have been privileged to study. A church that, for the most part, over the years has maintained a focus of that which really matters, maintained a focus of reaching the lost and unchurched world, maintained a focus of discipling and getting people into groups, maintained that kind of focus. Many of you, well, I don't want to be presumptuous, but perhaps some of you have seen the book that was really put together by my team, but I got the authorship privilege, called Breakout Churches, that talks about this church and 12 others. There was another part of this, of the research that I wanted to do, that was just too voluminous for the book, and it was characteristics of breakout leaders. I had wanted to do a sequel to that, but for different circumstances, I did not write that book, but I'm going to share with you the outline of what would have been that book tonight. You see, we studied 52,333 churches across America. And you don't just study a church by looking at numbers. You talk to people and you talk to leaders. And there's a pattern that begins to develop over the course of several months of research and listening. When my team was here, they attended some of your home groups and they interviewed leaders and they listened. And from this, we were able to distill some characteristics of effective leaders. In fact, I'm going to call this, instead of characteristics of effective leaders as advertised, I'm going to call this 10 characteristics of breakout leaders. And this applies to everybody who is here. Many of you are a part of this church, and you're a leader in some aspect. You're a leader of this fellowship. You're a leader of this body. Some of you have come from other churches and other bodies, and you are a leader there. What are some characteristics of breakout leaders? What are some characteristics of these men and women who have made a difference and who have been different than most Christian leaders, quite frankly, are today? I'm going to be sensitive to the time and in the course of this hour that we have together. I'm going to share with you those 10 characteristics, not in any particular order. Not that this is a comprehensive list of 10 characteristics, but a list nevertheless, so you can think about what God may be saying to you in the context of your own leadership. Characteristic number one, they have a long-term perspective. They have a long-term perspective. This is going to tie in eventually to characteristic number 10, which I'll get to when I get to number 10. They have a long-term perspective. Let's just talk about the pastors of these churches, lead pastors, the solo pastors, the senior pastors, whatever title they may have. They had been at this church over 20 years. Of all the churches that we studied, the most effective leaders had been there at over 20 years. This goes contrary to conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom says we get a quick fix, we make it right quickly, we get satisfied very quickly, and we move on. These leaders had a long-term perspective. They understood that it might not happen tomorrow, the next month, or the next year, but several years ago I wrote a book called Eating the Elephant. How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And they understood that sometimes their progress in their leadership role was incremental, but that was okay. Sometimes they took 3 steps forward and 2 backwards, but that was okay. They were willing to move on. Some of you may be discouraged in your leadership role right now because you don't see the progress that is being made. Perhaps it's because you don't have the vantage point of the long-term perspective. These leaders, first of all, had a long-term perspective. Number 2, now listen to this one. They had a personal priority of evangelism. Now hear that one more time. They had a personal priority of evangelism. Now what do I mean by that? That means that these leaders did not say, is my group evangelistic, is my church evangelistic first? Are the people around me evangelists? The first thing they said is, am I making contact with the unchurched world? Am I developing relationships with people personally? Is that who I am? Is that a priority? Do I wake up each morning with a heartbreak for those who don't know Christ? Is that my personal priority? Before I went into the world of academia and before I went to Lifeway, I served as a pastor of four churches in four states. The church that was my favorite was in St. Petersburg, Florida. And one of the reasons I love that church is because at the time I was pastor there, Pinellas County, Florida was about 92% unchurched. You couldn't be an effective church there unless you had people who were connecting with those who were not already connected with the church. And I began to pray that the Lord would give me a passion for this unchurched world and the community of which I was a part in Pinellas County, Florida. And by His grace, He did. And it was an amazing thing. Not only did I have the opportunity just to go out and make contact in different places within St. Petersburg and other communities of Pinellas County, but sometimes they came to me. We were about a mile and a half from the Gulf of Mexico, right where the Bocasiega Bay flows into the Gulf of Mexico. And it was not uncommon for people to just kind of end up at our church, whether they were on the beach enjoying the leisure time or whether they just had some kind of need. And one time there's this incredible man named Van who just showed up in my office. Van was a Vietnam veteran and he had had some tough times. And he decided that he wanted to become a citizen of Cuba just to get away from it all. And so he got into his sailboat and he sailed to Cuba and he was personally turned away by Castro. Can you imagine? And he had to get back in his sailboat, and this time he sailed up the Gulf side, and he ended up near St. Petersburg. But there's a little catch. Van, one of the reasons he wanted to leave the U.S. is because he had decided that paying income tax was not something that he preferred to do. And after 10 years of doing so, the Internal Revenue Service said, "We want you." And so they got after him, and that's why he got in his sailboat. And by the time he landed in the Bocasiega Bay, they knew he was coming, and they took him into custody. They took his boat and all of his possessions. They let him go on his own recognizance, and they said, you're on now, and here's your trial date. He had nothing, literally, but the shirt on his back. And he began to walk inland, and about a mile and a half later, he ended up at the church. I mean, imagine how he looked after being that long in the high seas, unshaven and dirty and smelly. And he walked by the lady who was supposed to clear anybody who came to my office, and she didn't dare stop him. She just told him to go in. And I look up, and there's this man that doesn't look like anything pleasant at all. And I stood up, and I said, "Can I help you?" He said, "Yeah, you can." He said, "I want three things from you." I said, "What is it?" "Number one, I want something to eat." I said, "Okay." "Number two, I want a place to stay. If you'll pay for it tonight, I'll pay you back before the week is over. I will work." I said, "I'll do that." I said, "But you said three. What's the third one?" He says, "Is this one of those places where you can learn about Jesus?" I said, "I hope so." He said, "I want to know about Him right now." And on that moment, he became a follower of Jesus Christ as I shared with him how Christ may transform his life. Van was an answer to prayer at that church. Because not only did he begin to have a personal priority of evangelism, but also he began to infuse our church with that. Now, I want you to understand that this was a fairly traditional church. And Van was not. Now, those of you here, I understand you may not be able to picture this scene, but it was a fairly formal worship service. And the deacons would come in coat and tie, and they would sit on the front row as a part of their tradition. Van assumed, because he didn't know better, that the most spiritual people got to sit on the front row. And so if he saw one of these deacons being less than Christian during the week, he would come in to the worship service on that Sunday morning and bring it to their attention. And he would walk in and he would say, "You hadn't been spiritual this week. Go to the back." And it got to the point where when Van would come in, these deacons would be looking over their shoulders. And if they had had a bad week, they'd get up and leave before he ever got to them. Van also had a way of taking things literally. One time during a message, I ended it up with a very unfortunate use of words. I was talking about reaching people for Christ, and I said, "Now you leave this place and go get you someone for Jesus." Van's eyes got wide. Van was an outpatient at the VA hospital, the psychiatric unit, and there were some of his friends that were more permanent residents there. And he took my admonition literally. Around midnight of the Sunday that I preached that sermon, going into the early morning hours of Monday, the phone rings. When Van was in a calm state, he would say, "Tom, I need to talk to you." But when he was excited, he would say, "Dr. Rayner!" Somewhere between 12 and 1, the phone rings. I pick it up, sound asleep. "Hello? Dr. Rayner! Is that you, Van? How'd you know?" I said, "Van, what do you want?" "You know how you told us to go get someone for Jesus?" "Well, Van, I didn't mean it a little." "Well, I got me three. I'll be over soon." Van had broken into the psychiatric ward of the VA hospital. And with his red Chevrolet pickup truck, had broken them out. And for whatever reason, he gave them guns of all different caliber and size. It was about 25 minutes from the VA hospital to my home, but Van made it in about 18. My wife said, "Who is that?" I said, "Oh, it's Van." She says, "Oh, go back to sleep. I know how he agitates you." I said, "No, I think I'm going to go for a walk outside just a minute." So I went outside. Within just a little more than 15 minutes, here comes this red Chevrolet pickup truck. And there are these three of the happiest guys I've ever seen in the back of the pickup truck. And they're shooting their guns into the air. And they're yelling and they're screaming. And Van's grinning from ear to ear. And he said, "I set him free. I set him free." But he had to go because there were these two cop cars right behind him. Van shook up our congregation. But he had a personal passion for those who don't know Christ. And the characteristics of breakout leaders is they don't wait for others to have this passion. Many of them have a prayer life that says, "Lord, according to your will, allow me this day to have contact with someone who doesn't know the Lord, that I may show them through my actions and words his love." Many of these leaders say it didn't come naturally for them. Some of them say it did. But all of these breakout leaders of 52,333 churches, of the literally thousands we interviewed, one of the characteristics of these leaders is that they had a personal priority for the lost and the unchurched, for evangelism. Characteristic number three, they love people unconditionally. They love people unconditionally. Now that seems so simple and self-evident. Okay, Jesus loved us unconditionally, and so we're to love others unconditionally. But let me ask you this. Have you ever met someone that is unlikable? In your workplace, in your school, in your neighborhood, in your family. You ever met an unlikable person? Many of these leaders told us that they had a transformation moment. Many of them said they had several moments where they realized that they were to love people as Christ loved them unconditionally. And it was that type of love that made them the kind of leader that they are even today, because they loved people where they were and loved them even if they were unlovable. Now, I have kind of a perverse humor. And don't take that too far. I'm going to explain that. One of my favorite chapters in the entire Bible is Acts 5. You know what Acts 5 is primarily about? Ananias and Sapphira. You remember those two dudes? They sold all of their possessions, or at least they sold their land. And because there was this great deal of excitement that was going on in the church, they wanted to get in on the wave of excitement. So they said, we gave all the money that we got from this land, the sale of this land, to the church. But they lied. Peter knows that they lied. Whether by some type of direct revelation or from God or just someone telling him, he knew that they had lied. And so the text begins in Acts 5, verse 1. It says, but a man named Ananias, with Sapphira his wife, sold a piece of property. However, he kept back part of the proceeds with his wife's knowledge and brought a portion of it and laid it at the apostles' feet. Now, let me give you the RSV translation of this. That's the Rainer Simple Version. Ananias walks in, and Peter says, hey, Ananias, what's up? Ananias says, not much. Things going great. Hey, Ananias, Peter says, I hear you sold your land. Yeah, had a great realtor, got a great price, low commission, and you've given all that money to the church. That's right. Bzz. Ananias is wiped out. So even some of you are trying to hold back your chuckles right now. And then Sapphira walks in, the wife. Has anybody seen Ananias? Peter says, yeah. Let me talk to you about that just a minute, Sapphira. Move his feet, boys. Sapphira, and he asks the same questions. And finally he said, and you gave all the money to the church. Oh, yes, I did. Bzz, she's dead. In some of the churches where I have been a leader, I have been in some meetings where I've had fantasies of Ananias and Sapphira. I know that's sinful. But you know, there's sometimes I just look at someone and the way they're acting, and probably someone looks at me that way, and I just want to say, take them out, Lord. Bzz. One of the greatest tests of these breakout leaders was someone that was close to them that was unlovable. Many times it was a direct family member, and they said one of the key transformational moments of their lives where they truly became the kind of leader that God was using is when they began to see people through the cross, when they began to see people as Christ sees them. They love people unconditionally. In our massive research of leaders around this nation and beyond, of over 52,000 churches, the fourth characteristic of a breakout leader is this: they have confident humility. They have confident humility. Now, that seems like an oxymoron, but there were words that were associated with these leaders that often aren't associated with leaders from a secular point of view, and these words were servant-like, Christ-like, humble, other-centered, deflects accolades. These leaders were confident because they knew that they were doing a God thing. They knew that it was God who was using them. They understood that. But they were also humble because it was a God thing. They knew that they could be confident because it was God's power. But they were humble because it was not their own power. Many times in the world of leadership, and we have to confess, even in Christian leadership, that confidence begins to overtake that humility, and we no longer see the Spirit of Christ in people. All we see is arrogant leadership. These leaders had confident humility. Characteristic number 5, they led with focus. They led with focus. You've heard it in many different ways, in many different forms. They made the main thing the main thing. I recently released a book called Simple Church. And the whole thesis behind Simple Church is let's focus on a few things. It's based upon a research project, again, of churches that have just begun to shave away and do away with all the things that really don't make a difference. And they begin to focus on a few things and do them well. It is possible in any church, this fellowship, any congregation, to get detoured and distracted. The first church where I served as pastor was founded in the late 1700s. I'm not that old. I was not their founding pastor. It still had its original building from the mid-1800s. It was out in the country. It was a stone church. In other words, the building was built from the stones that were in the little river that flowed by. It still had two front doors, originally one for the women and one for the men, as they went to their opposite sides. It was my first church. Why did I take that church? Because nobody else would have me. I just knew that God had called me to a vocational type of ministry, but people would hear me preach and they would say, "Don't come back." So finally, I met with this church. I met with the leadership of this church, and they said that they wanted to consider me as their pastor. And I said, "Why would you want to consider me as pastor? Why do you think God would be calling you to call me as pastor?" Well, I met with a search committee. His name was Merle. And Merle took the wad of tobacco out of his mouth. And when he thought about that statement, "Why do you think Tom Rayner might should be the pastor of this church?" He thought for a moment. He said, "Well, because ain't nobody else applied for the job." This was my sense of God's affirmation to keep moving in this direction. The church had seven people total. When everybody attended, there were seven there. And boy, did they have their traditions. It was amazing that even with a tiny church like that, how much baggage had accumulated over the years that was still there. Let me just tell you about one of them. On my first Sunday as pastor, I preached from Matthew 28:19, better known as the Great Commission. And before I could even finish reading the text, one of the seven members, the eldest of the ladies in the church, stood up and she said, "Turn on Jesus." I thought, this is Baptist, isn't it? But I tried to proceed with the text. Before I could get any further, she kind of leaned forward and she said, "Turn on Jesus." Well, I was still confused. Not knowing what to do, I tried to read Matthew 28:19 hurriedly. And this time she stood up and she shook her finger at me. And she said, "Young man, I said, turn on Jesus." I stopped. I just put my hands out like that. The entire leadership team came up to stand by me. His name was Merle. And Merle told me something as he whispered in my ear. A few years ago, the church had gotten electricity. And they had a picture of the likeness of our Savior on the wall. It's my story. Let me finish it, all right? And before anyone would teach or preach, someone had to go plug it in and illuminate the picture and thus turn on Jesus. That little church in southern Indiana became a church that, in God's power, despite all the obstacles, began to reach people for Christ. It became one that began to have a passion. Why? They started doing away with the extraneous, that which didn't matter. They became, in the best sense of the word, a simple church, not because they were small, but because they focused on a few things well. Leaders lead with focus. It is so easy to become distracted here or there and to say, this is the path that we want to go and this is the route that we want to go, and to forget to make the main thing the main thing. New Testament leaders lead with focus. Number six, another characteristic of a breakout leader is that they have an obvious passion. They have an obvious passion. I have trouble defining passion, but I know it when I see it. We can be passionate about the wrong things. We can be passionate about the God things. The world is looking for men and women who are sold out to something. Or perhaps I should say, sold out to someone. And these leaders can recall again a transformational moment in their lives where they said, Lord, allow me just to spend the rest of my life doing what you want me to do. Let me just, in your power, overcome the barriers. Let me move on. Let me move forward. Lord, don't let me waste my time doing that which does not matter. They have an obvious passion. Characteristic number seven. They welcome feedback. They welcome feedback. I am thin-skinned. When you write a few books, people begin to email you. And every now and then, I get an email where I want to write back, you ignorant, but I don't do that. But I am thin-skinned. And as the Lord has allowed me to be in leadership positions of different levels, one of the things that I have done is I have set up some type of accountability where I am always receiving feedback. The positive feedback, I enjoy. The negative feedback called criticism, I hate. Now, I know I need it. And hardly a week goes by that one of my accountability partners that gives me this constructive feedback does not tell me something that I don't want to hear. But it has sharpened me. And despite the hurt that I often experience with the immediate sting of the criticism or the correction, I pray that it has made me a better person. I learned to take feedback by being a husband and a father as well. My wonderful wife of almost 30 years encourages, and every now and then, zing. My three sons, zing, 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 then encourage. They've done a lot of things with their dad. One of the things they're doing right now is they all three decided to get married around the same time. So we got a wedding next weekend in Cincinnati. Then we got a wedding a couple of months later in St. Louis. We got another wedding a couple of months after that in Louisville. Idiots all getting married around the same time. Now, these three boys are 26, 24, and 21. They're going to bring us wonderful daughters. They're just great, great ladies that they're marrying. But one thing that they have done all throughout the years is that they have kept their dad humble. Not that I would have any trouble knowing who I am, but they have kept their dad humble. My middle son in particular, he called me up 6 months ago right before a speaking engagement. He said, Dad, I just listened to one of the CDs of a presentation you made a couple of months ago. I said, how'd you like it? He said, didn't. He said, Dad, you rattled off a bunch of statistics. I want you to go back. I'm going to send this CD back to you. I want you to listen to it, Dad. You are one of the most boring people that I've ever heard in my life. Let me give you another example from that same middle son. If you are a middle child or if you have a middle child, you're weird. You may be good weird, but you're weird, okay? And this middle son is just different. The oldest son is type A. The youngest son loves everybody. The middle son is just different. He's just different. My middle son liked to have large groups over at the house when he was in high school. And his senior year, he said, Dad, I've invited a few people over right after this high school event. I said, oh, how many are coming? He said, 100, 200, I don't know. 120 showed up. Now, listen, I'm no longer a pastor. I don't have to exaggerate. That is a true story, okay? The reason I know that 120 showed up is my wife at 3 a.m. in the morning told me to go count the shoes that she had told them to take off, and I counted 241 shoes. I don't know what happened to the odd shoe. I just rounded to 120. And around 3 in the morning, as I'm looking at this big crowd of then teenagers hanging out at the house, music going loud and conversation above the music, somehow in the midst of this, I hear in the next room Art, my middle son, talking to Aaron, a self-proclaimed atheist. He doesn't even believe God exists. I tune in and eavesdrop on that conversation, and they begin to get in. Art says, Aaron, I've been your friend for a while. I really need just to talk to you about Jesus. Aaron says, I don't believe that Jesus stuff, Art. He says, but listen, God, before he could even finish the sentence, Aaron said, I don't believe in God. Art can't stand it. He says, but the Bible says, and Aaron says, why do you think I believe that book of myths? I don't believe there is a God, I don't believe there's a Jesus, and I don't believe the Bible has any truth to it at all, except for a few historical facts. They began to debate back and forth. Art, I must say proudly, is pretty good at apologetics. He can defend the faith fairly well, and he's beginning to answer some of the questions that Aaron, the atheist, is asking. They're going back and forth, like a verbal tennis volley, and just going like this and that. And finally, Aaron, the atheist, asks Art, my son, a question, and Art pauses. He says, I can't answer that question. He said, but I want to tell you something, Aaron. You're lucky. There's someone here that knows the Bible. There's someone here that has studied theology for many years. You're lucky. There's someone here that can answer the tough questions. So he goes to the kitchen to ask my wife, his mother, this question. And once again, I am totally humbled. I wish my bride could be with me today, tonight. He asked her, he says, Mom, I want to ask you a question. He asked the deep theological question from one of the first early chapters of Genesis. And she thinks for a moment. She says, you know, I just don't know. She says, why don't you go ask your dad? And my beloved middle son responds, Mom, I don't want to know that much about it. That is how. I have gotten feedback over the years. You're at a leadership institute. You're not here unless you're a leader. At least you're not here unless you want to be a leader. Do you have some kind of built-in safeguard where you're getting some kind of feedback on a regular basis in many different areas of your life, your ministry, your teaching, your leadership? The breakout leaders made certain that they welcomed the feedback, both positive and negative. Characteristic number 8. This is 8, isn't it? Are you with me? For those of you who are going, sometimes I wonder that I lose account. Characteristic number 8. They are people of hope and promise. They are people of hope and promise. I read recently where one of the projected hot new games that will be on the market in a matter of years is a game where you put on a headband and it measures brain waves. And you have someone else who puts on a headband. And likewise, for he or she, it measures brain waves. And there is a table where you sit and a strip of some type of metallic substance. It measures the brain waves. And as one person thinks, there is this ball in the middle of the table that causes the ball to move in one direction or another. Except this game is a little bit different. The purpose of the game is very much like soccer. The idea is to move the ball toward your opponent into a net-like at the end of the table. But the way that you move the ball is to stop thinking. When you think, it moves it in the direction opposite that you want it to go. And so, empty minds tend to win the game. Some of you may know people who would greatly qualify for this game. What did the Apostle Paul say in Philippians? He said to the church at Philippi, whatever is lovely, whatever is good, whatever is praiseworthy, and the list goes on, and he says, think or focus on these things. One thing that we noticed in our survey, in our study of these breakout leaders across the land, is that they were people of hope and promise, and that is what went, that was the input that went into their minds, and so the output was hope and promise for those that they led. They were not ostriches that had their head in the sand, oblivious to the negative that is around us, but they believed that they served a God through whom all things are possible, and they communicated that reality on a regular basis. They were people of hope and promise. They were people who understood that what Jesus Christ had done for them was nothing but grace and hope. And when we have Him, if we have that mind focused on that which is right, we cannot help but to communicate that same hope and promise. Well, I don't have to state the obvious, even though I will. You who are part of Zenith know this. You who are guests to here know this. It's a hurting world. You know the obvious, that there is a lot of pain that is out there. And you also know the obvious, too, that there are those who are looking for some kind of hope. The leaders were those who said, I am going to focus upon the promises of God. I'm not going to be oblivious to the sinful realities around me, but I am going to focus upon the promises of God. And as a result, I am going to convey that hope to others. Those are the kind of leaders that became breakout leaders. Characteristic number 9. They take their ministry seriously, but they do not take themselves too seriously. They take their ministries seriously, but they do not take themselves too seriously. Now, you already know my cultural background. I'm a Baptist from the South. And you know that when people come into our church, we dunk them. We immerse them. And I couldn't wait in that little church in southern Indiana that Merle was the de facto leader for the opportunity to baptize the first person that became a follower of Christ. Her name was Bert. Let me tell you the story about Bert. I just, for some reason, traveled in that little rural community, went up a gravel road to the mobile home where Bert lived, newlywed to her husband Steve, and I just wanted to go talk to her. I'd already developed a good talking relationship with Bert, but here's the thing about Bert. Bert had the reputation, she's only 20 years old, but she had the reputation of being the meanest, most profane person in that rural community. 2 weeks earlier, she had spent overnight time in jail for beating up two men in a barroom brawl. And I'm traveling up in my little Ford Escort, and I'm praying as I travel up, Lord, please don't let her be home. Please don't let her be home. But in the rural community where the culture was such, you could just show up at someone's house. I showed up in her mobile home, and she's outside, and she's on a horse riding it bareback. She's trying to break the horse. The horse bucks her. I'm still in the car watching this. She gets down off the horse. She grabs it by the reins, and she hits the horse in the snout with her fist. And the horse is going, and I'm looking through the windshield of my Ford Escort. And I'm thinking, Lord, I'm going to go talk to her about Jesus, and she's going to beat me up. I get out of the car. She says, "What you want, preacher?" That's what they call me. And I just began to develop a conversation with her. The relationship had been established for several weeks. And I said, "Bert, I just want to share with you about the love of Jesus." And she just broke. Christ just came into her. She was a new creature. She accepted what Christ had done on the cross for Bert. Steve came out, her husband. I shared what had happened. And because I'm from a Baptist church, I said, "Bert, now I need to talk to you about baptism." She says, "What's that?" And I explained to her how we Baptists put you all the way under. And she started shaking like this. I asked Steve, her husband, what was wrong. He described her condition. He didn't use this word, but the condition was hydrophobia, fear of water. In fact, she had such a fear of water, she didn't bathe nor shower. She used a bath cloth to clean herself. Anything above ankle high caused her to be very, very fearful. I don't know the origin of it. And you know, sometimes I can just imagine that God is in his heaven. And he just kind of looks down. He says, "Peter, John, Rachel, Mary, come watch this Rainer guy. This is going to be funny. This is going to be hilarious." You see, I had never baptized anyone by immersion. And my first one was going to be someone who feared water, who beat up men for a living. I thought about it for a moment. I said, "Bert, have you ever considered being a Presbyterian?" She said, "No, I can do this." So 2 weeks later, in a barred church and a barred baptistry, it was time for the baptism. I looked out. We'd only been having about 20 people at this point in attendance. But I looked out, and there were over 300 people for that afternoon baptism. Now, my wife said there were 35, but I'm a minister, so I counted a little bit different. And I was standing waist high in the water, and Bert was on the steps where she could not be seen by the congregation until she came into the water. And so I said, "Bert, come into the baptismal waters." And she just shook her head like this. I tried again. "Bert, come into the baptismal waters." She shook her head like this. I looked out at over 400 people in that congregation. I wasn't going to blow my first baptism. So I just prayed a prayer silently to the Lord. I said, "Lord, help." Lord gave me a word. Lord spoke to me. He said, "Jerk her in." So I grabbed her by the arm like this, and I began to pull. She was stronger than I was. She started pulling me, but I had the leverage of the steps, and I pulled her in. And now she was waist high in the water, and she was shaking like a weak leaf in the wind. Well, it's time for the baptism. I looked at it, over 800 people, and I was just ready to go through with this. I said, I'd heard other preachers do this. I said, "Bert, upon what profession of faith do you come?" I told her to say, "Jesus is Lord." She didn't say anything. "Bert, what profession of faith do you come this afternoon?" She didn't say anything. So I looked out at the congregation. I said, "She said, Jesus is Lord." I lied in my first baptism, but I want you to know that the Lord knew she meant it in her heart, okay? So I looked at her in her white gown, ready for this Baptist baptism. And I said, "Bert, in obedience to the command of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and upon that profession of faith, I baptize you, my sister, in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen." Bert could sense my hand coming up behind her head. She could see the other hand coming toward her face. Now, I want to interrupt this baptism story to tell you something. I have no doubt that Bert was a Christian. I have no doubt she was a new creature in Christ. I have no doubt that she was regenerate. I have no doubt that she was born again. I have no doubt that all of her sins have been saved. I have no doubt. But you know, sometimes we Christians revert back to our pre-Christian behavior. And there was this little microphone that was hanging down that could hear the baptismal candidate. And she decided to speak for the first time right before I was going to put her all the way into the water. And she said, and I quote, you touch me and I'll knock out of you. And what bothers me is you leaders understood every word that I just said. Some of you were mouthing it with me. It was time to put her in the water, and I said, I'm going to go through with this anyway. I began to push her in the water. She locked her knees. I started mashing on her face like this. She wouldn't go down and into the water. I looked out at a crowd of some 12,000 people. And I just stopped for a moment. I just paused, and I'm thinking, Lord, what I do? Help me, help me. Lord gave me his second word for the day. He had me look into the water right behind her kneecaps. Kick her. So, boom, like that. She went down and she bit me, and I still have a scar to this day where she bit me. Now, I want you to know that story is only mildly embellished. Most of it is true. And why did I tell you that? Because a Christian life should be one where we laugh. Leaders should have joy that is effusive. These Christian leaders who were breakout leaders took their ministry seriously. They took their service seriously, but they didn't always take themselves too seriously. Sometimes in Christian ministry, it seems like we're so uptight that you can hardly move. Now, probably not at this church, but anyway, at most churches. Characteristic number 10, and finally, and then I'm going to go in to see if there's any questions about this research. They recognize the brevity of life. Now, tie that in to number 1. Number 1 was they had a long-term perspective. Number 10 is they recognize the brevity of life. I was in Naples, Florida, a little over a year ago, on a warm December day in South Florida, when the phone rang. My wife and I were celebrating our then 28th anniversary. And the unexpected words came that you have heard in different ways at different times. But the words that we heard about my wife was, it's malignant. It was unexpected. The first surgery, the second surgery found it had spread to the lymph. The chemo that followed, the radiation that followed that. Here's my wife's testimony. It is one of the greatest blessings I have ever had. How could she say that as the hair fell out? How could she articulate that as she grew sick with each passing treatment? She said it helped her to realize what really matters. It helped her to appreciate how brief this life is. Whether we live to be 25 or 95, it's but the blink of an eye. And the breakout leaders understood that they had very little time. They didn't want to waste it. They focused. They had a perspective for the long haul. They loved people unconditionally. They were confident in God's power. They had passion. They welcomed input and feedback. They had hope and promise. They enjoyed life. They laughed because they knew that this life was so incredibly brief. If there's one characteristic of breakout leaders that stood out to me and my team as we interviewed, it was that. Time's wasting. Got to make a difference. Can't waste this opportunity and this beautiful gift called life. Time's wasting. You ever had those wake-up calls? I've had them in different ways myself. I remember one of them when I was a student at a seminary and I was working 40 hours a week for my wife and family to get through the financial needs that they had and going to school 15 hours a week, studying 30 hours a week, just burning myself out. had a cockiness about me, an attitude that, though I didn't articulate it, said, man, God really needs me. And I'd come home every night about 1 a.m. and get up at 5 a.m. and I'd start all over again. And that was my pace until I crashed physically, and then I'd do it again. Now, I told you my three boys are 26, 24, and 21. At this particular time, they were 5, 3, and 1 just born. We were living in campus housing. They called it Seminary Village, but we called it the Gospel Ghetto. And we were in this little 600-square-foot apartment, all five of us. And my three boys were in one room, one little bedroom. And one night I came home, and I came home just because I was tired. And I came home at 10 p.m., and my eldest son, Sam, called. He said, Dad, come here. You know, thinking about the Sunday called Father's Day, if I had been the kind of father I should have been, I would have run to my son, my five-year-old little man. But instead, I ignored him, but he persisted and he yelled out, Dad, please come here. This time, if you could have seen my face, you would have seen it turn a crimson red. If you could have felt my pulse, you would have felt it racing. If you could have measured my blood pressure, you would have seen it rising. I was mad. It was 2 hours past his bedtime. I went into the room where his two younger brothers slept. I slammed the door open, and I began to yell at him. Sam Rayner, what are you doing awake? Don't you know it's past your bedtime? I'm tired. Go to sleep. And he responded, I'm sorry, Dad, but I haven't seen you in 2 weeks. I just wanted to tell you I miss you, and I love you. These cheap Venetian blinds were open, and a full moon shone right on my little man's face. And he was holding back sobs, but silent tears fell. And if Jesus Christ had been visibly present, he would have been no more real at that moment. And I shouldn't have, but I began to sob convulsively. And I just began to break. I know I shouldn't have in front of a five-year-old kid, but I did. And when I finally got some semblance of composure, I spoke to my little man. I said, I'm sorry, Sam, but your dad's been a lousy husband to your mom and a lousy dad to you. And my prayer life has been non-existent. I hadn't spent time in God's Word, and I haven't loved people, Sam. Will you forgive me? And my little man, as I knelt beside him, put his arms around what must have seemed like massive shoulders, and he squeezed me as hard as he could, and he said, yeah, Dad, I forgive you, and Jesus does too. How come I can remember that moment in 1985 so vividly? Because Jesus said, life is short. Get your priorities right, Tom. Stop messing around. Do what I want you to do. I have had the beautiful opportunity through my team and me of listening to hundreds, and with the entire team, thousands of leaders across America. Leaders who are making a difference. We call them breakout leaders because there was a point in their life where they were not, by their own admission. But now they are. I could have quoted you a plethora of statistics and facts that would support all of the data that you just heard, but I thought it would be best if you heard from the hearts of these leaders. And these leaders are making a difference. And many of you are too. And many of you can do more. It is my prayer that you'll take these characteristics of breakout leaders, one, two, or perhaps several, and say, Lord, change me that way well. Change me like these leaders. Let me make a difference in this brief moment called life. I thank you for the opportunity to spend this time with you. I didn't catch an airplane because I just wanted to drive and think. So I drove all the way from Nashville. We'll drive back just as soon as I get done. I know I'm an idiot to make an 800-mile round trip, but I've had time to pray and to think. Perhaps you have some type of question related to this research. Maybe I spoke so much from the heart, you want a little more data, or you want a little more information. We have about 10 minutes. And if anybody has any kind of question, I'll be just more than happy to take it. Anyone? I can't see you, but I hear you. Oh, a guy out front. Guy up front, what do you have to say? Here comes the mic.
How you doing?
I'm great.
I'm looking over this this list, and I'm actually seeing seeing something that I'm thinking you overlooked a little.
Tell me.
About a year ago, I heard those same words that you heard. You know, it is that it's malignant, and I heard that from about my mom. And you know, just 2.5 months later, she was gone. And you know, one of the big impacting moments was, you know, one by one, everybody in my fellowship just would come over and just give me the biggest hug I could ever have. And, you know, one of these characteristics that I think you might have overlooked is just the most compassionate heart that you could see in a person in a time of crisis, in a time of need. So
the thing of compassion, right? I think it is wrapped up in that statement about how they love to learn, how they learn to love other people. That true compassion just began to emerge from who they were. So I think you're absolutely right that that is a part that we could extract from that, but that compassionate love was evident in that statement. Well stated in my prayers for you and your family. Any others? Middle?
Are there any of these?
Hey, if you came from the South, you could make it four syllables.
You said you found these 10 typically in breakout leaders. Are there some that you would say you typically don't find in typical church situations?
Say that again. Let me get clarity.
You said that, I don't want to just repeat it. I'm trying to think how to reword it. But
let me see if I'm hearing it right, and you tell me. Are these typical characteristics or atypical characteristics of church leaders? Is that what I'm hearing?
I'm asking if there's some qualities that you typically don't find in non-breakout leaders.
A lot of these.
Okay.
A lot of these. I could almost go one by one and say in the non-breakout leaders, it is common to find that there is a more confidence in self than confidence in God. In the breakout leaders, in the non-breakout leaders, there tends to be less accountability than accountability. And I could almost go down the list and give you some percentages that would bore you, as my middle son would say. But you can almost do an inverse of this for many of the non-breakout leaders at different percentages and different levels. Did that answer that? Thank you. Over here. Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering if you might be able to talk about the role of suffering that these leaders took on, you know, how they perceive suffering, how they dealt with it.
Very good question, how these leaders perceive suffering. Most of these leaders and these churches had a crisis moment. In the church, the crisis took on a corporate form, but in the lives of these individuals, it was very personal. Most of their theology of suffering did not see God as the author of that which was bad, but saw God using that which had the suffering had been. Let me give you an example. Pastor of the Temple Church in my hometown of Nashville, Tennessee. I did not know Michael Graves until I did this study, an African-American. His church went through turmoil to be a breakout church, and he personally went through the darkness of the soul. He ended up in the hospital with serious illnesses. He spent weeks and weeks in the hospital. And who does want to spend that time He did not see God as the author of these difficult moments, but he saw God using these difficult moments. And that tended to be a common theme that we heard among these breakout leaders, that God used these tough times for his glory. And by the way, Michael Graves was the only one of the leaders in my breakout church research that did not get to see the book. He died 1 month before it was released. I hope that answers your question. Yes, sir. Here it comes.
I was wondering how these breakout leaders handled failure.
By their testimony, poorly at first. Every one of these, by the very definition of being a breakout leader, had some type of failure. Many of them described a period of self-pity, a period of desiring to give up, a time where they wondered if they were even cut out to be a leader. But obviously, because they are a breakout leader, something happened that turned that into a different direction. Most of the time, that which turned it into a different direction was another Christian who came alongside them and held the arm up of leadership, and these people saw that they could keep on even in tough times. But the reality of it is, most of them dealt with failure fairly poorly at first, but then they turned. One more, and then I'll close it.
Some of us from this church have gone on these trips. They're called, well, they call them like exer tours, where we visit other churches and try to find out some of the same things that you are. And I was just curious about how you guys do the research. Like, what do you ask? And could you just give like a, obviously very brief, but like a rundown of the type of things, the way you find out what you find out?
No. You said very brief. I can't do very brief. We'll end on a boring note. There are two types of research. There's objective research and there's subjective research. Objective research is where they fill out some type of survey that can be tabulated. Subjective research is where you do intense interviewing and get a lot of insights into personalities, flavors, and things that cannot come out on some type of objective data. We have chosen to go both ways. We've chosen to do the objective as well as the subjective. That is an expensive endeavor. But that is the path that we've done because we feel like we can get our screen of churches through the objective data, and then we can listen more intensely through the subjective data. And that doesn't answer it completely, but it's the best I can do in just a brief while. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been my joy to be here. I'm going to go back to Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm going to tell some folks I was at a church that starts with an X and let them try to figure it out. God bless you.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.